Everyone, I think I'm going to go ahead and get started. Welcome to Get Lit, Why Story Matters. I'm Jill Myers, and I'm going to start out this talk with a little reading. Actually, there's going to be a lot of reading. I hope you like being read to. I'm going to read you a small segment from Sonny's Blues by James Baldwin, and we're going to get into I'm going to get into sort of more about that in a bit. I read about it in the paper, in the subway, on my way to work. I read it, and I couldn't believe it, and I read it again. Then perhaps I just stared at it, at the newsprint spelling out his name, spelling out the story. I stared at it in the swinging lights of the subway car, and in the faces and bodies of the people, and in my own face, trapped in the darkness which roared outside. It was not to be believed, and I kept telling myself that as I walked from the subway station to the high school, and at the same time, I couldn't doubt it. I was scared, scared for Sonny. He became real to me again. A great block of ice got settled in my belly and kept melting there slowly all day long. While I taught my classes algebra, it was a special kind of ice. It kept melting, sending trickles of ice water all up and down my veins, but it never got less. Sometimes it hardened and seemed to expand until I felt my guts were going to come spilling out, or that I was going to choke or scream. This would always be at a moment when I was remembering some specific thing Sonny had once said or done. Okay, what we're here to do. I gave you a little bit of Sonny's Blues there by James Baldwin. That's one of my favorite short stories. It's a classic. I'm sure many of you have read it in high school or college, and it's very, very widely anthologized, and there's lots of reasons for that. But what we're here to do is talk about why fiction matters. I want to share some great stories with you, that story included, and some others. Many of you have copies of American Short Fiction. There are copies of this journal that were passed out. And if you didn't get a copy, you can approach the table at the end. I have a few more up here, but I'm going to be reading and talking about a few stories from this magazine, which is a magazine that I edit. And talking about them as examples as well. And then finally, I'm going to be getting into examining what makes these stories tick, what makes them great, and what techniques of fiction can we pull from these stories and start to apply to our own writing. What can we grab from great fiction and apply to writing more universally? And I also want to pause here and give myself a little bit more of an introduction. As I mentioned before, I'm Jill Myers, and I'm the editor of American Short Fiction, and that is a local literary magazine. We're based here in Austin, but we're a national magazine. We're distributed nationally. And we publish fiction that is wild, heartfelt, and new. We look to publish emerging writers alongside established writers, and to really give emerging writers that first boost, that sort of career launch, and look to connect them with new audiences. So we're very excited about fiction that really challenges and inspires. And so I'm going to be talking about some of those stories here as well. So fiction, why? What we can learn from it, missed that slide. What we can learn from it is these four things. And I feel really deeply connected to fiction, and I feel moved by fiction quite often. And I think there's a lot as writers that we can take into ourselves and apply to our own writing from fiction. And first of all, what we can learn from fiction is various methods of engagement. That fiction has a way of making sense out of nonsense, or giving us a pattern in the midst of noise. That fiction in itself is fun and playful, but yet there's a logic to the game. Fiction can also give us a sense of empathy or connection. And there's actually been studies done, I've been reading in Scientific American about this, and that that fiction actually has a way of lighting up, as we're reading fiction, it lights up different areas in our brain and actually teaches us to be more empathetic. It teaches us to be more connected. It teaches us to reach out to others and to develop, actually to develop sort of social connections and social skills. And I think that from this we can sort of learn how story does this generally. Stories give us a sense of discovery and resonance that we feel reading a good story, telling a good story, we feel is a meaningful exchange, and in a way that stories are our currency, our true currency, that they're the way that we stay current with one another, but they're also the way that we exchange meaningful information with each other. And ultimately, stories are a way of transporting us, of deeply moving us and changing us. So that's all the vast array of things that fiction and storytelling can do for us. And how fiction does this? These are three main elements of fiction, and there's various terms for these things, but this is sort of boiled down to the simplest, and these three aspects of fiction, these three elements of fiction, you can really grab and use in various kinds of writing. So fiction has voice, fiction has conflict, and fiction has insight. These things are integral to a good story and are what make fiction meaningful. And roughly, these translate to voice translates to who, and conflict translates to what or how. And insight, more or less, translates into why you're reading this story. What conflict may propel you, it may get you to turn the pages, but ultimately you're searching for some deeper connection or some deeper insight, some revelation that's there embedded in the pages. So voice, let's talk about voice. Voice provides the transmission of the story itself. It's the means by which the story gets told. It also establishes authority. And what I just read from James Baldwin, from Sonny's Blues, you got the sense that this was the right person to tell this story, that this story mattered to this person, and he was the only one, he was the right one to tell it. And so when you are thinking about crafting a narrative and shaping the voice for that narrative, you want to think about who is the appropriate voice for the story. And finally, voice immediately offers a human element, unless, of course, the story is being told by a dog. But you want to feel that immediacy, that urgency in that voice. And with that opening bit that I read, you have that urgency there. You are immediately in the story, and the voice is what takes you there. Vulnerability is a really, as well as urgency, that's a key element to voice and to getting people excited about the writing that you're producing, the writing that you're providing them with. So a little bit more about what James Baldwin is up to. In that voice, we hear gorgeous cadences, just an incredible rhythm. And those three-part sentences that I read, particularly in the first paragraph there, I read about it in the paper in the subway on my way to work. I read it, and I couldn't believe it, and I read it again. So that's incredibly easy rhythm for us to kind of fall into and parse. And it's just an incredible, easy rhythm, but also one that compels you to read along. The language is pretty simple. It's not taxing, and yet it's the language choice is really interesting. And you feel a true personal connection there. You know that he's reading about it in the paper, that he's reading about Sonny. You want to keep going. Another thing that I should say about James Baldwin, and that isn't immediately present in the section that I read, but that we'll encounter later on, is just his incredible range in his voice and his ability to kind of tip into this grander language and also to make beautiful sort of biblical references and use sort of a preaching cadence. And Baldwin actually was a teenage preacher, and so he sort of carries that with him into the language of the short story. And he says, The 3 years that he spent in the pulpit, I didn't realize it then, but that's what turned me into a writer, dealing with all that anguish and despair and beauty. So he sort of takes the rhythm of being in the pulpit, of speaking as a preacher, and brings that into the story. And you can hear that throughout Sonny's Blues. So I want to read a little bit more from Sonny's Blues and talk about voice just a little bit longer. This is actually the third paragraph. It's still, we're in the opening of the story. And he says, when he was, we're just continuing on, he's read about it on the subway. You know that he's thinking about Sonny. When he was about as old as the boys in my classes, his face had been bright and open. There was a lot of copper in it, and he had wonderfully direct brown eyes and great gentleness and privacy. I wondered what he looked like now. He had been picked up the evening before in a raid on an apartment downtown for peddling and using heroin. So here with the voice, we've had this sort of incredible delay. We're three paragraphs in now. We're past the first page. And there's been this sort of incredible delay of information, this sort of suspense. We're itching to know. Because in that opening paragraph, we just kept hearing it over and over again. I read about it in the paper on the subway. I read about it, but I couldn't believe it. So we've just been fed this word, it, over and over again. And we finally, here at the conclusion of the third paragraph, get what it is. And it's that his brother, Sonny, has been picked up for peddling heroin. So we get this sort of grand reveal through language at the end of that. So next I want to talk about conflict in this story and others, but I thought first I would take a quick moment and give you another example of language that's being used well, a good example of voice that's in this current issue of American Short Fiction. And I just want to read you the opening of the Great Central Pacific Guano Company by Maggie Shipstead. And this is on page 29, if you have a copy. At first, there were many, 40 men, a dozen women, 10 children. But most of the children were born on the island. But one was born in France, another in Saigon, another at sea. Ships brought the wood and bricks that made our village, the corrugated sheets of tin for our roofs, the panes of glass, the kerosene, the pots and pans, the bottles and jars, the cloth, the shoes, the soap, the cement, the school books swollen with humidity, the year-old ladies' magazines for our governor's young wife, the sweets for the governor's son, the flour and sugar, the dragon fruit, and pineapple and mangosteen. So we're already sort of seduced into this list of things. And as you read further with this story, you'll see that the voice very soon turns dark around the edges, that there's a lot on this island that's not right. And it's sort of through the voice that we get to know that. And one thing that's an interesting choice here in this story is that this writer has chosen to tell this story in first-person collective. So we get the repetition. And one of the interesting sort of language choices in Baldwin in that opening bit was the recurrence of it, that we get it sort of beat over the head with it until we find out what it is. And with this voice, we're hearing it through the we. We're hearing it through this, it turns out to be sort of this collective body of women who are telling this story. And you hear the we repeated throughout the story. And it becomes kind of its own cadence. And there's a reason why we is used in this story, this kind of collective voice, and it's actually used to hide, a particular woman who commits a crime, and she's hidden behind the rest of the we. So it's a very compelling reason. So that's another example of sort of voice working for you. But to move on to conflict. Conflict is about tension or drama, about events that are causally linked, and about story shape. These are the things that you kind of want to think about as you're crafting a piece of writing, about creating that tension or drama, creating a sense of forward motion, of someone wanting to move along with what you're creating. And in terms of the... Just a quick word about the causally linked idea here. That is more about the idea of, instead of having a list of actions just running one after another, the classic example is the king died and then the queen died. But if those were causally linked, you'd have the king died and the queen died of grief. That there needs to be sort of a causal hinge, a sense that one of the events is affecting the next, and there's sort of this cascading effect. And with shape, there's the sort of classic pyramid or triangle, the sense of rising action, the major conflict at the peak, and then falling action. And that shape works. There are also plenty of other shapes and zigzags and ways that stories can be told backwards. You sort of have to find the right shape for the narrative that you're crafting. But I would say that you do need to have a shape in mind as you're telling your story. So in Sunny's Blues, to return to Sunny's Blues, I just want to sort of pick out a few bits of where we sense conflict and where we sense the story kind of picking up. And as we hear these bits, we get to know more about the relationship between these two brothers. It's Sunny, and the narrator of the story, the teller of the story, is actually never named. We never get to know who he is. We get to know his wife. We get to know about Sunny, his brother, and even some of Sunny's musician friends. But the narrator himself is never named. So we hear early in the story that Sonny has been picked up for heroin, and he's gone for a bit. And the narrator and Sonny don't communicate. And then we get this bit. "I didn't write Sonny or send him anything for a long time. When I finally did, it was just after my little girl died. And he wrote back a letter, which made me feel like a bastard." So that's not a lot of text. That's not, we're not given a whole lot of words there, but we feel sort of the engine of plot moving forward. We feel that the engine of plot is kind of heated up, and that we are getting an understanding of what's happening between these two brothers, what sort of the nature of their conflict, and also the sort of home life of the narrator as well. And I feel that conflict has to be very much grounded in character, in the story that you're telling. Later, when the narrator has picked up Sonny, they go for a cab ride. This is after Sonny has gotten out of prison. "The 7 years difference in our ages lay between us like a chasm. I wonder if these years would ever operate between us as a bridge. I was remembering, and it made it hard to catch my breath, that I had been there when he was born, that I had heard the first words he had ever spoken. When he started to walk, he walked from our mother straight to me. I caught him just before he fell, when he took the first steps he ever took in this world." So again, we're just kind of getting a little bit more of a establishment of their relationship, and we're getting to know sort of the responsibility that this narrator feels for Sonny. And as the story moves along, it fills in these details, and we learn about the differences between the brothers and the real sort of difficult conflict that they have. They look at the world very differently, and I think that makes for a very lively and rich story, and it's incredibly compelling. "All right," I said. "I'm ignorant, I'm sorry. I'll go out and buy all the Cat's records right away, all right." "It don't," said Sonny, with dignity, "make any difference to me. I don't care what you listen to. Don't do me any favors." This is when the narrator and Sonny are they're talking, and the narrator is on leave. His Sonny is staying with his fiance's family and is training to be a musician. And the narrator says, "I was beginning to realize that I'd never been so upset before. With another part of my mind, I was thinking that this would probably turn out to be one of those things kids go through, and that I shouldn't make it seem important by pushing too hard. Still, I didn't think I would do any harm to ask. Doesn't all of this take a lot of time? Can you make a living at it?" He turned back to me and half leaned, half sat on the kitchen table. "Everything takes time," he said. "And, well, yes, sure, I can make a living at it. But what I don't seem to be able to make you understand is that it's the only thing that I want to do." "Well, Sonny," I said gently, "you know people can't always do exactly what they want to do." "No, I don't know that," Sonny said, surprising me. "I think people ought to do what they want to do. What else are they alive for?" So you can see, again, just that these two are, there's really sort of amplifying the difference between them, and that the conflict is really sort of coming into focus, that these two believe in living a very different way, and that at the start of the story, the narrator is an algebra teacher at a school in Harlem, and Sonny has just gone to prison. And they have very different points of view of the world, and that really drives the story. I want to just touch on another conflict that's in this issue of American Short Fiction, and it's in There's a lot of action in this story, and that's in Robert Boswell's American Epiphany. And we're in this story, and there's a tornado. There's a wife who's gone to pick up her husband. He's been hospitalized. He's been in a psychiatric ward, and she's gone to pick him up, and it's a tornado has been approaching, and then they are driving home in the midst of it. The toll road, this is on page 62, the toll road was as wide and empty as the future. The wind had not left them, only fooled them. And a few miles down the road, she knew that they were in trouble, the mortal kind. The storm at first moved indifferently around them, coiling them in its mad upheaval, but leaving them untouched. They seemed to be the last unopened box under the tree, and they were wrapped in the most salacious kind of porn. But they went untouched because the box seemed to be empty, which is to say, she was afraid and her mind was racing. And then every feature of the landscape distorted, as if the wind had made the light crooked, and she felt a gate swing open in her head, a searing snap in the place between her ears, and they were witness to something as elemental as birth. Something that defied any human name for it, a world where trees stood on their branches and walked like men, where a rusty farm implement, a giant thing like bedsprings, armed with vicious blades, won the lottery and got to dance weightlessly and gracefully in the trembling sky. With the unlit Hardy sign in view, the car took to the air, spun once, a lateral swirl, as if they were being stirred, and dropped them abruptly to the asphalt, aimed approximately in the same direction in which they'd been traveling. "Be careful," Dimitri said, roused from some reverie. There weren't many men who could get lost in their thoughts during such a ride, but her husband was one of them. There was a seat cover over the bench seat, and the spinning of the car had caused it to slip free and bunch under their legs like wrinkled skin, as if the storm had aged the car, and she half expected to see the paint on the hood turn gray. "The fucking wind picked up the whole car," she said. "It wasn't my driving. The mistake I made..." He paused, and she got the car going again, her heart beating in her throat, and she wished the wind would lift them again, shake them like a jigger of gin, anything but hear how she betrayed him and cost him some share of his mind. "You have to think about sides," he said, "that there are two sides to every issue." "I'm sorry," she said, and there were tears in her eyes. "I'm so sorry, but one side obscures the other." So here we have a lot of action sort of in the forefront of the car getting tossed in the air. There's sort of the action and drama of this actual moment of them being in this very dangerous situation. But also there's, in this incredibly beautiful way, there's this other human conflict running underneath that, which is, as we come to know in this story, that she's had an affair, and her affair has actually led to a breakdown on his part, and she feels this incredible regret and sort of despair about her affair, and so that's also this very human conflict that's happening underneath their wild ride. So the final thing that I want to touch on here before we get to questions is insight or observation and revelation. Also, this in sort of classic short stories in the James Joyce sort of version of the short story, this is the Epiphany. And Flannery O'Connor, a phenomenal short story writer, one of my favorites, said that so many people now can write competent short stories that the short story as a medium is in danger of dying of competence. We want competence, but competence by itself is deadly. And I think, what she's getting at here is that if a story with a great voice and with that's driven by action and conflict, that's compelling, that's interesting, you'll read that. But I think that we all are truly craving a story that gives us some new insight or some new way of looking at the world. And what we're really looking for is vision. So in Sonny's Blues, to return, what we get at the end of that story, it is sort of shaped like it's a classic short story, and so we do get this vision tucked at the end. Other stories handle that in other places, or sort of come up to an epiphany, sort of dance up next to an epiphany, and then pull away. But in Sonny's Blues, we get this incredible vision at the end of this story, and I want to share that with you because it's just incredibly lovely. And what has happened at the end of this story, and one thing that I should say about this insight is that in writing, in that we all kind of we want to come to that. We want to be surprised by insight or by a new revelation, but we also want to feel that it's earned, that we sort of, either as readers that we have to work at it, or that the person telling the story has sort of had to work to come to this. Because if someone is just kind of offering us insight after insight, or insights right off the bat, it feels sort of more bossy, or it doesn't have sort of the structure and the comfort of coming to a surprise later. So in Sonny's Blues, we get to these insights at the end of a story, and at the end of the story, Sonny has convinced his brother to come with him to a jazz club. So earlier in the story, we had gotten this sense of conflict where the narrator didn't think a lot about jazz. He didn't consider it as something his brother should be doing. And at the end of the story, the two adults go to a jazz club where Sonny will be playing. And this is the end of that story. Then they all gathered around Sonny, and Sonny played. Every now and again, one of them seemed to say, "Amen." Sonny's fingers filled the air with life, his life. But that life contained so many others, and Sonny went all the way back. He really began with the spare, flat statement of the opening phrase of the song. Then he began to make it his. It was very beautiful because it wasn't hurried and it was no longer a lament. I seemed to hear with what burning he had made it his, and with what burning we had yet to make it ours, and how we could cease lamenting. Freedom lurked around us, and I understood at last that he could help us to be free if we could listen, that he could never be free until we did. Yet there was no battle in his face now. I heard what he had gone through and would continue to go through until he came to rest in earth. He had made it his, that long line of which we only know Mama and Daddy. He was giving it back, as everything must be given back, so that passing through death, it can live forever. I saw my mother's face again and felt for the first time how the stories of the road she had walked on must have bruised her feet, how the stones of the road that she walked on must have bruised her feet. I saw the moonlit road where my father's brother died, and it brought something else back to me and carried me past it. I saw my little girl again and felt Isabel's tears again, and I felt my own tears rise. And I was yet aware that this was only a moment, that the world waited outside as hungry as a tiger, and that trouble stretched above us longer than the sky. Then it was over. Creole and Sunny let out their breath, both soaking wet and grinning. There was a lot of applause, and some of it was real. In the dark, the girl came by, and I asked her to take drinks to the bandstand. There was a long pause while they waited, while they talked up there in the indigo light, and after a while, I saw the girl put a scotch and milk up on the piano for Sunny. He didn't seem to notice it, but just before they started playing again, he sipped from it and looked toward me and nodded. Then he put it back on top of the piano. For me, then, as they began to play again, it glowed and shook above my brother's head like the very cup of trembling. And so finally, at the end of the story, it's quite a long story. The narrator comes into this new understanding of his brother and his brother's suffering. And it's this moment that couldn't have been achieved earlier in the story, that he sort of needed to go through this terrible conflict with his brother, this incredible tension and lack of understanding and work through that in order to come to this beautiful moment at the end. And there's also a reference, the cup of trembling is a phrase from the Bible, from Isaiah. And there's this sense of this cup of trembling having been taken out of Sonny's hand, or this sense of hardship that's been taken from him, but that hardship still exists, that it could still be revisited upon him. And so that's this moment that's incredibly suggestive and incredibly poignant that we come to at the conclusion of this story. And so I just want to give you one other example of that kind of insight that's used in a different place and in a story, just so you can sort of think about how to fold in insight into your work. And this is from Tate Higgins. It's a first story in American short fiction. And this is on page 17. This story happens at an alligator farm that is... it's set up like a tourist attraction. Tourists come and look at alligators and walk around and Crawl is their tour guide. And he is in the midst of things. Crawl can answer lots of questions. Finger has taught him in the evenings while stacking empty beer cans on the picnic table. He can talk about how an alligator grows to 5 feet in a year and is ready to reproduce by her first winter, can explain that a female alligator is territorial and that a male spends weeks floating along till one day wakes and wanders from his deep water eddy to black swamp all hours of the day in search of food and sex. I'm not sure I understand your question. The question is, can you tell me what makes an alligator tick? Here's what I mean. It's clear what makes a person work. The man takes off his hat. He rubs his hand over his bald head and looks around the crowd to see that they're all on board. But what makes an alligator stay alive? How do they do it? Why do they do it? The man leans way out over the fence for his answer. Crawl lets his flat palms float along the surface. The water is warm, full of alligators. The girl with one hand steps out of the crowd to stand next to the man. He hasn't seen her since this morning. He's been looking for her all day. What this man is trying to say is, how do you know they haven't given up on you and decided that they like someone else better and that you're just food to get them to the next day? How do you know they haven't changed their minds? How do you know you're safe? It's her eyes that get him to answer with what's really in his head. Her eyes and the way she waves her stub around for emphasis, not trying to hide at all. Crawl lifts his hands out of the water, exhales, doesn't glance over the pond behind him because he can feel the old fear telling him to, and he wants to master it. None of us is ever safe. he says, and he means it. So that's another place where, you know, obviously it's just placed in dialogue. There's nothing particularly special about that revelation. And yet, if you're reading the story, it comes as a surprise, as a shock, as this bit of information from this character that you weren't expecting. And it struck me as an incredibly important moment in this story, and just sort of as an incredibly important thing to remember as a human being, that none of us is ever safe. So it certainly that insight doesn't have to be placed at the end of whatever you're writing, that insight can come in the midst of things and still make people really excited and feel compelled to keep going. So I want to take a few minutes to talk about sort of some of these techniques and how you can sort of look more closely at voice, at conflict, at insight, and what you can do to sort of start practicing these things and start using some of these fictional approaches in your own writing. And for voice, I just recommend reading voraciously and imitating whatever you get excited by. And imitate, appropriate, try on lots of different voices, be that the voice of a newscaster or a child, of Borges or, you know, your favorite science fiction writer. Try on a variety of voices and see what works for you. In terms of locating conflict, I think that actually we can borrow a lot from the improv world in our writing and sort of locating conflict. And I think that part of that is thinking about relationships that are fraught. If there's a tense relationship between, say, two brothers who are fighting after their mother's death, or just, you know, two people who have a lawsuit, the sort of classic face-off sort of TV that we all watch of two people going up against each other in a courtroom with different perspectives on events. Just sort of thinking about these different approaches to the same situation, how people have different reads and people have different needs in situations. And finally, as you're sort of thinking about your own writing, your own work, what sort of problem are you addressing? If you can sort of step back and look at that in context, what makes this dramatic? What makes this important? Why would people sort of feel a conflict or feel a tension without what you're working on? And finally, I just kind of want to get into your questions, but offer up these three things that you can pull from fiction. Looking at developing a distinct voice, riveting the reader with a sense of conflict, of drama, of action, and finally the sense of giving someone something new that you want to land in. You want to land somewhere new. You want to be transported. You, at the very least, if it's not something shocking and new, at least it's something valuable that they can take with them. And so we now, that's the end of sort of my scheduled comments. And I just want to say, you know, all of what I've brought out here, these have been examples from fiction, but of course, everything that I've talked about can be applied to many different kinds of writing, and that you can seize these things and take them with you and make your writing better understood. So now I feel it's a great time for questions. If you have any, there's a mic on the floor here. We can just kind of open it up for any questions at all. Or we can all go drink early. Well, thank you for coming. Again, I'm Jill with American Short Fiction, and please let me know if you have any questions, come up and ask me directly. There's also a few more copies of American Short Fiction up here if you want some more swag to add to your bag. Thanks again.